hopefully will learn well. It should be a, it should give them special protection. Okay, so we're approaching now the month of Adar. Tuesday and Wednesday is Rosh Chodesh, and then we are 14th. The 14th of Adar is Purim. And so what I'd like to do is today is two things. One, I want to talk about the holiday. There are four major mitzvot that we are commanded to fulfill. So I want to talk about that a little bit, just to give us some color as to like the how we observe the day. And then I want to kind of jump into an idea about the story, talk about the story in general, and then I want to go to specifically an idea that it's kind of a novel idea. When I say novel, like it's kind of a, like a little bit of a chiddush, like a new idea, very powerful idea that I think is very something that practically that we can bring into all of our day, like into our lives, that can really hopefully enhance our relationships and things of that nature. So you'll see. Okay, so we're going to take a little. We're going to be traveling here. Okay, so first things first. On the top of the sheet, I put here. The four mitzvot that are unique to the day. The first one is reading the Megillah. So we have the Megillat Esther, the scroll of Esther, which we're supposed to read twice, one at night of the holiday and one during the day. So the idea of the of hearing the Megillah is to really I guess we call it persume nisa. The farsim is to make the miracles to be able to the farsim is to make it advertise or put it out there, promote, that's a good word, promote the miracle. That's a great way of saying it, thank you. Promote the miracle. So that's one. Number two is gifts for the poor. The idea is that we're each supposed to give at least two poor people money or something of that nature, a gift to the poor. That's actually given tremendous, like if you have only a certain amount of money, and what would be the priority? The first thing you're supposed to do is give money to the poor, specifically for Purim, as opposed to other charity one would do. The day, by definition, says that we have to give charity to two poor people, okay? Number three, gifts to friends. There's also, you did the gift to the poor. There's the idea of giving shalach manot, to give a gift to friends. Two gifts, two friends, and give them two prepared foods. Something that they can use for their meal. Because the last thing is to have a festive meal. That is not during the night, but during the day. During the day, it could be in the morning, could be in the afternoon, and can even go into the next day, but the idea is to have that meal, a festive meal, during the day of Purim. Okay, those are the four. So you have reading the Megillah twice, giving gifts to the poor, gifts to friends, and a festive meal. That's the holiday. Those are the, like, if you're going to, like, what are the four things we're going to have to do on Purim? These are the four things. Okay, it's like, Thanksgiving. Right? Everybody has to have a meal. It's like it's become like, right? So we're saying Purim is the same idea. That meal is like to use our, right? It should be like that. We get together with friends, with family, and it's supposed to be a happy time celebrating the Purim holiday. Okay. So now I bring down, I in the source sheet here, I put in the Talmud from Tanit 29a. The Mishnah teaches that from when the month of Av begins, one decreases acts of rejoicing. Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rabbi Shmuel bar Shilat, said in the name of Rav, just as when Av begins, one decreases rejoicing, so too, when the month of Adar begins, one increases rejoicing. So the Talmud is showing us like kind of a contrast. Av is a time of sadness or a decrease in joy. Adar, which is our month coming up, it's the idea we're supposed to be really happy.
So Tisha B'Av was
in Av, right?
Okay, and I remember that class. Okay,
so now we're coming into the happy, like a very festive, this is a really happy time. Okay. Now everything in Judaism is like, but practically speaking, like how does this translate? It translates to the point of where the mazel for the Jewish people during this month is excellent. So if you have to go to court No, I mean, it sounds funny, right?
Schedule it now.
Yeah. Adar, you have a parking ticket? Go now. You're in Adar because it's supposed to be an auspicious time. So, but the idea is that we're supposed to be really happy. So we're supposed to increase, and as the not just from Purim, but the month itself has a special energy, right? We talked about this idea of different times of day, different times of the year that are auspicious, like Pesach. Passover comes in the time of the spring. There's something very powerful and positive about the springtime. Adar has that, and it's not a coincidence that Adar and Nisan are back to back. That we have this idea of the two being together because there's a certain connection of this. It's a good time for the Jewish people. So when you think about that, you're supposed to smile because, well, we actually have good times in there. It's not all doom and gloom. And the answer is yes, it's not all doom and gloom. Okay, so let's talk about this idea of the Megillah story. I just want to give you a quick synopsis of for anybody that's not familiar. But from there, there's the Talmud in Chulin that brings us into the Talmud in Megillah, and then we'll have this new idea that we're going to introduce today. Okay, so now, the story is that after the first temple's destruction, the Jews were sent into exile, but it was a short exile. It was a 70-year exile, and the Jews were in Persia under the king was Ahasuerus, and it was not a positive time for the Jewish people. The beginning of the story comes, and there's this party that Ahasuerus is having, which is that they thought that there was a promise that the Jews would be brought back, that there would be salvation from this exile after 70 years, and then the way they calculated it, it didn't appear that it came, and so the Jews were down in the dumps. Ahasuerus was made a party using the vessels from the Beit HaMikdash, and there's a lot of drinking, a lot of wine being poured in the whole story. That's why when we talk about the celebration of the holiday, it's always revolving around drinking wine, because the same way that all the negative was happening within the context of all these parties, and wine specifically is mentioned, so that when we celebrate with wine. That's where you have this idea of drinking on Purim and getting intoxicated. It's kind of in the context of where all this is, all the story is, have the backdrop are these parties. So Ahasuerus, this is a difficult time for the Jewish people under the realm of Ahasuerus. And then we have all of a sudden Haman, a second character shows up who basically rises up through the ranks to become the most powerful person in Ahasuerus' kingdom. And he is the arch enemy of the Jewish people. He represents Amalek, which we're going to talk about, but the arch enemy of the Jewish people. And he says to Ahasuerus, we have to destroy this problem, the Jewish problem. We have to annihilate them. And what's different than the Hanukkah story, where they just wanted to, they wanted to destroy our tradition, here Ahasuerus, very similar to what happened recently in our time with Hitler, Yimach Shemo, is that he wanted to just annihilate the Jewish people. He wanted to wipe us out completely. And then we have Esther and Mordechai who come along, and Esther is like, we watch the series of events. It's miraculous because it's so counter. Everything is going in the direction of Haman becoming powerful, getting his way to be able to destroy the Jewish people completely. And then out of nowhere, miraculously, Esther shows up in the kingdom as the queen and is able to reverse and have Haman destroyed, and then the Jewish people have salvation. Okay, so there's a lot of, there's so much to talk about within the story itself, okay? But what I want to focus on today is what these characters represent. Haman, Esther, and Mordechai. Who are these people? Or what do they represent? Because we said that Haman is this arch enemy of the Jewish people. And what does that represent in our history? Because it doesn't just end with the story of Purim. So there's a takeaway of what this Amalek Haman school of thought represents. And we need to understand it well. The Gemara in Chulin is going to kind of highlight that for us. And then from that, we're going to see an incredible thing about Esther. Really unbelievable. And that's the take home for us today. Okay, and then hopefully it'll make everybody happy. Because that's our goal here, is we have to be happy, right? Okay, so let's look at this Gemara in Chulin. The residents of Papanaya said to Rav Matna, if one found a nest on the head of a person, what is the halacha with regard to the mitzvah of sending away the mother? So we have this, one of the 613 is the idea of shiluach hakan, right? You have a nest, the mother bird is there with her chicks or with the eggs, she's sitting on it, and you come along and you see this nest. The mitzvah is that you're supposed to chase away the mother bird and take the chicks. Okay, so it's one of these, like, you're giving, like, what? Okay, so I'm not going to get deep into this one. And I actually mentioned it to I study with Michael Baer, and I mentioned him, and he was like, what? And I'm like, I know, we have to go and open up the...
Unravel that one.
Yeah. Exactly, okay, but we're not going to get into that. We're not going to dive into that now. But just let's say that that's the mitzvah, okay? It's chasing away the mother bird and taking away the chicks, okay? And the idea, I guess, is if you're going to take away the chicks, the nice thing to do would be to send the mother away. I'm not delving into that one right now. But what it does, the Gemara is asking, it's funny, the Gemara, a lot of time, the Talmud will ask questions in a way that you don't necessarily understand what it's asking when you look at the story. And then I'm going to tell you what it's really asking. Because the morale... Prague explains to us what the Gemara is really asking. Gemara has this weird case. Let's say you found the nest on the head of a person. So, right, you have the nest on, and I have a nest on my head with the mother bird and their kids. What's the story? What do you mean, what's the story? Does the mitzvah apply? Because the mitzvah says that if you find a nest on the ground or in the tree, then the mitzvah applies. What if it's on a person's head? So what? What's the question, right? You're like going, what?
Ridiculous.
No, but what the Gemara is asking is a very deep question. How do I understand the human being? Is a human being a human being? Are they part of the ground? Or are they above the ground? What I mean by that is they're a spiritual being. So like, for example, if I say, for example, that it's a spiritual being, so then in a sense... Let's say you're walking along and there is a bird's nest suspended in the air miraculously. Then the whole mitzvah of shiluchan does not apply because it's not on the ground. So if you see it on a person's head, do we look at it as the person is a spiritual being? The head represents the highest level, the intellect of man above the ground. So therefore, it would be like looking and seeing a nest suspended in the air. Or do we say no? A person, the Torah calls the human being, Adam, Adama, from the ground. So a human being is of earthly, we're flesh, we're of the ground, so therefore it's as if it's on the ground. So that's what the Gemara is asking. What's the nature of a human being? Are we elevated beings or are we physical beings? That's the question the Gemara is asking. How does it asks in this.
What's the answer?
It's an argument. It depends on who... No.
Or maybe couldn't you look at it just like, well, the other person already made a mitzvah and took the nest already.
Meaning it's on this person's head already. Like, meaning that's what they're doing?
No, so they pushed the mother away.
Right,
so
the Gemara... But the Gemara's, question really is just tell me about... What is the nature of the human being? Because let's see what the Gemara is going to continue on. Because it's a stream of thought. What's the next question? Where do we see Moses in the Torah? So, sir, what do you mean, where do I see Moses
in the
Torah?
Everywhere.
I see him everywhere, right?
Oh, okay.
Meaning I see him all. So the Gemara is asking, Maral explains, the Gemara is asking an unbelievable question. We have this understanding that that God looked at the Torah, whatever that means, he looked at the Torah and used that as his blueprint to create the world.
That's the other way around.
Wait.
Didn't he create the Torah to make the blueprint?
Oh.
Yeah. I'm confused.
As the blueprint. Like as the blueprint.
Okay. So God, it says God looked at the Torah and from that he created the world. Istakel b'arayta b'ra'alma. Okay. Now, what that means is, so the five books of Moses, is that exactly what he looked at? Or is there some kind of primordial, like, you know, some kind of higher level Torah, conceptual Torah that existed? But there's a however we explain that, but there's something that Hashem is looking at called the Torah that he looked at and used it as the blueprint for creation. Okay? So then the Gemara is asking now, in that higher spiritual Torah, where do I see a hint of Moses? Meaning, is there, where's the, I want to know about the root of Moses pre-creation. Where do I see that in the Torah? So the answer is Bishagamhu Basar, that he is of flesh. Let's see it inside here. From where in the Torah, it's like, you see, like, you go four lines, yeah. From where in the Torah is the existence of Moses alluded to before his birth? He replied with that the verse for that he was also of flesh, is flesh. Therefore, shall his days be 120 years. This is talking within the context of the pre-flood with Noah. Okay? But the idea of Moses is that he is of flesh. Okay, what does that mean exactly? We're saying that Moses, who became the most spiritual, lofty person, the one who had the highest relationship or understanding of God of any human being that ever lived, he's of flesh. That's like to say that that there's this, his spiritual pre-world existence, a hint of him is that he'll be of the flesh. Okay? We're not going to focus on that either now. Okay? there's a whole extra class we could talk about, the connection between Moses and Haman. And that's what there is that element that's going on here in this Gemara. But I want to focus now on Haman, on Haman, Esther, and Mordechai. Okay? So then, they also asked Rav Matna, from where in the Torah can one find an allusion to Haman? He replied, the verse states that Adam, after Adam ate from the tree of knowledge, have you eaten of the tree? Hamin ha'etz, Hamin, Haman. Did you eat from the tree? Okay? About which I commanded you that you should not eat. Okay? So Haman, Hamin. So again, this is all allegorical. But the Gemara is trying to tell us something very, very, very crazy deep here. Okay, what is it saying?
Again, wait, the word Haman refers to what, though?
Did you eat from the tree? Oh, Hamin. Haman, hey, memnon.
Yeah, is from.
Is Hamin.
That means from.
It means, literally means from.
From.
Okay, that's what I was asking. Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But connecting to the tree.
Got it.
The tree of knowledge. Going all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Okay? So that there's an allusion to Haman in the Torah, going back to
the beginning,
of time. Okay, that tree. What is the problem with that tree? So the Maharal says to us, he says, you know what, that tree, well, let's see. Before they ate from the tree, man was supposed to live forever. When they ate from the tree, guess what happened? Death was introduced into the world. So now we're saying that Haman, I want to understand, Haman, where's there a hint to him? It's connected to the tree. To that sin, to the sin that led to death, evil. To creation of evil, and what was connected? What brought Adam and Eve to eat from that tree?
The serpent, the snake. Was the snake Mordecai?
No.
Oh, okay.
Who is it? Who is it? Haman. Haman has a connection to that snake. Okay. So now what the Talmud is telling us. That and so the Maharal tells us something very important here. This is, I think, for me, the takeaway is that what the Talmud is telling us is that I want you to understand something about this person is that they're coming from a very powerful place. This is pre-creation, beginning of time. This evil is not just some simple evil; it's going back. Even pre the existence of the world, because it says we're from the Torah, this early stage before the world's even created, the blueprint of the world. Where is there a hint for Haman from this already? From this horrible thing that introduced death into the world, right? The evil. That's Haman.
I know, okay? I'm taking you off topic, and you can say another time, but So you're saying Haman, and they're making these correlations. Did anyone ever do that with Hitler, or was he too modern?
No, so that's what they'll say.
You didn't take that class when we were on the weekend where they did the whole all the words and all the discoveries. You were in that class with me.
Yeah, here in the shul.
No, no. On the
but,
this,
but the answer
they
is
here also. Yeah. They did it
the answer. The answer would be that Hitler, Yimach Shemo, right? That his name should be obliterated. That he is connected to this same Amalek.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? He's very much. That, if anything, if what's crazy is when you put into this context. When you put into this context, when we understand Hitler, it's easier something that we can relate to because it's in our time, relatively speaking. But can you imagine now how bad Haman was? If he was even worse than Hitler? It's hard. It's again, it was so hard for us, but that's what we're saying here. Okay? And it's coming from a very deep, very powerful, like we should never underestimate our enemies. An enemy like this is coming from a very, very bad place. Okay? So then the next, there is a positive at the end of this thing, okay? There's a light at the end of this tunnel, okay? They also asked Rav Matna, but again, to appreciate it, you have to see the darkness sometimes, right? So the darkness is this, it's going back to the beginning of time, and it's really bad. It's a bad, 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 very powerful, very, 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 very powerful and very bad thing. Okay, so now, they also asked Rav Matna, from where in the Torah can one find the allusion to Esther? He replied to them that the verse states, "Then my anger shall be kindled against them on that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall come upon them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will hide, haster astir, my face from the day on that day for all the evil which they shall have wrought." Excuse me, so that we see this idea and that they were turned to other gods. So the idea of Esther, haster, astir, it's the idea of being hidden. Hidden, but double, twice. Haster, astir, it means really hidden, okay? So what's the really hidden aspect of Esther? So we're going to see something about Esther in a second. But also, just in terms of the Purim story, there are two hidden, God's face is hidden times two. Achashverosh, Haman. You have two things going on. It's not just you're dealing with a Haman, you're dealing with an Ahasuerus, which is already negative, and then you layer on top of that this horrible evil. So like they like to compare, I'm not getting political here, but Ahasuerus sometimes Donald Trump, okay? But this idea of like the world is crazy. Whether you like him or you don't like him, everybody agrees that this is not conventional, right? So you could have a king that's just like unpredictable, okay? Ahasuerus, so that already causes angst and anxiety. And then you bring Hitler. Can you imagine? It's like, holy, you know, like the heads were exploding, okay? Bad, right? And here's Esther. She has to exist in that darkness, the double concealment, okay?
So haster, Esther means what?
And she's double hidden. Haster, Esther is hidden. Okay. Hester Pundit is God's face is hidden.
I see.
Double. Now it's on.
Yet somehow two. She'll be the representation of good.
Yes, we're going to see. I'm going to get
keep
there.
Going.
Okay?
Okay, keep going.
Okay, so her power comes. Esther's power is in her tzni'ut. Now, tzni'ut means, how do you translate? Modesty, right? The answer to that is not correct. Okay, but I mean by that in a way is I don't because today that's how it's translated, modesty. Okay, we're gonna see from today's class how we got there. It's not wrong, but it's not the answer. True tzniut is not translated as modesty. We'll see what it really means. Okay, and when we see that, it's gonna be like, okay, I'm gonna reveal what is Amalek at its core. And what's the answer on our side? Because we have an answer. Because Esther is an answer. Mordechai, where do we see him in the Torah? From where do we find the allusion to Mordechai? He replied, as written, with regard to the anointing oil in the tabernacle, and you shall also take the chief spices of flowing myrrh, Mordechai, and we translate Mordechai in Aramaic as Miradachia, which resembles the name of Mordechai, which means it's a spice. Which is what? Tied to the incense offering, Ketoret. Okay? If you open up the Torah and you read about the Ketoret, it's very powerful. It has this incredible power to it. Incense is very powerful in terms of what it does in terms of the spiritual realm. It saves us from death. The Ketores, there was a magefa, there was a plague, and they brought the ketoret, the incense, out, and that the plague stopped. So ketoret is actually a counter to death. Okay, now how exactly that works, it's another discussion. But one thing I can tell you, ready for this, is important. The ketoret is brought in the temple once every day in one of the inner chambers. And once a year, it's brought into the most inner chamber, the Kadosh HaKadoshim, the most holy place in the world. The Yom Kippur service is highlighted by the incense offering. That's what the high priest comes in once a year to the Holy of Holies, and that's what he's bringing, the incense offering. So it's done in a place of incredibly quiet, away from the crowds. It's in the inner sanctum, in the most private place in the entire world. Okay? Okay. Okay, so what do we have so far?
Esther. No,
we leave Moshe off. Moses is going to leave out.
We have Esther.
Now.
We have...
we have Haman.
Haman, and we've got Mordechai.
Okay, so we have the most evil guy from the beginning of time, the evil. We have Esther.
Hidden.
Hidden beyond hidden. And we have Mordechai, who's the idea of the incense, which is brought also in the hidden, in a sense. Okay, so you see that's why Esther and Mordechai are really like their tag team against Haman. Okay, so now let's see. One of my favorite Gemaras. Okay, this is now everybody knows a story about Jacob. He comes down he goes from his parents' house to his uncle, go love him, and he gets there and he gets to the well, and who's there? Rachel, at the well, and he's overtaken by emotion. He cries. He kisses her. There's all this like question, like what's going on there, and the Gemara here is going to explain their first conversation that they have. What do we know? In the end, he ends up getting married to who? To Leah, right? And then ultimately, then later on to Rachel. And it gets complicated. Okay. But the Gemara here is going to tell us their first conversation, okay? But the Gemara first starts out and says, he withdraws not his eyes from the righteous, but with kings upon the throne, he establishes them forever, and they are exalted. Okay? This is a line from Job, okay? But what is this? This teaches that in reward for the modesty shown by Rachel, she merited that Saul, who is also modest, should descend from her. And in reward for the modesty shown by Shaul, he merited that Esther should descend from him. Okay? So what do we have here? We have Rachel, our mother. Her modesty, which we have to figure out what that means. Okay? Begets Saul, who exhibits the same attribute of modesty, who therefore begets Esther, who has the same character trait of it's called modesty, but it's called tsniut. Okay, so the translator is using modesty. We're going to see whether we agree with that or not. Okay, let us use our exalted power of reason to see what we think about this. The Gemara explains what it was the modesty shown by Rachel. It is as written. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother. And that he was Rebekah's son. Wait a second. He wasn't his brother, right? And it may be asked, was he Jacob, in fact, her father's brother? But wasn't he the son of her father's sister? Right? He's not the brother. He's his nephew, right? Rather, what does it mean when he says that he is her father's brother? Rather, it must be understood that when Jacob met Rachel, he said to her, "Will you marry me?" First time. Love at first sight. He says, right when he meets her, he wants to marry her. He proposes. And she said to him, "Yes, but my father, Lavan, is a swindler, and you will not be able to outwit him." Jacob alleviated her fears as he said to her that he is her father's brother, referring not to their familial affiliation, but rather to his ability to deal with her father on his level, as if to say, "I am his brother in deception.
I'm his equal.
Yeah, I'm his equal.
You're not going
to
get me."
She said to him, "But is it really permitted for the righteous to be involved in deception?" She's like, wait a second. I thought you're a righteous guy. All of a sudden, you're like, What are you, like, you know, how does this work? I thought you're righteous, supposed to be straight. Now you're telling me that you're devious? He said to her, yes, it is permitted when dealing with deceptive individuals, as the verse says, with the pure you will show yourself pure, and with the perverse you will show yourself subtle. So you have to, like, when you're in a situation with someone that's a conniver, you have to, like, you know, you can't be a pushover. You got to step up to the plate. Indicating that one should deal with others in the manner appropriate for their personality. Fine. So therefore, I'm your brother. I'm your father's brother. I'm equal to him. Jacob then said to her, what is the deception they will plan to carry out that I should prepare for? Like, what do I have to watch out for? Rachel said to him, I have a sister who is older than I, and he will not marry me off before her, and will try to give you her in my place. So Jacob gave her certain distinguishing signs that he should use to indicate to him that she was actually Rachel and not her sister. So they set up already, right from the get-go. So there's no way we got love on. We're heading him off at the pass. He's not going to be able to outflank us. When the wedding night arrived and Laban planned to switch the sisters, Rachel said to herself, now my sister will be embarrassed, for Jacob will ask her for the signs and she will not know them. So she gave them to her. Mm. And this is as it is written, and it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. What do you mean, behold, it was Leah? Didn't he? Because that's when he found out for the first time that it wasn't Rachel.
But why did Rachel give her sister the...
Ah, so that's a good question, okay? But she was worried about her sister being embarrassed, right? So she steps up and gives over. We have to talk about this. We need to think about this for a second. But does this imply by inference that until now she was not Leah? Rather, due to the distinguishing signs that Rachel had given to Leah, he did not know until now, when it was light outside, that she was Leah. Therefore, Rachel merited that Saul should be descended from her due to her act of modesty in not revealing to Jacob that she had shown the signs to Leah. So that's the translator is learning it one way. I'm going to learn it differently. But right now, what this is saying is that the quote-unquote, the modesty of Rachel is that she protected her sister Leah. Okay, mm-hmm. Fine. Mm. Okay, I don't know if I agree with that. We're going to talk about this. But let's see the next two examples. And what was the modesty shown by Saul? As it is written, but of the matter of the kingdom of which Samuel spoke, he did not tell him. So what's the story here? So Saul, he goes looking for something. There were animals, there were cattle that was lost. He went to look. He finds Samuel, and Samuel actually pulls him aside and actually anoints him king of Israel, first king of Israel. But tells him, gives him very, very strict instructions. Do not tell anybody. You cannot tell anybody, because this was not to do something like this on the QT is not the way it should have been done. So now, yeah. Sam, okay, right?
And why was why Samuel do it? Allowed to give him?
Because Samuel's he was the leader of Israel. Oh,
okay,
he's
okay.
He's a prophet. He has whatever his basis is.
Okay,
but clearly he should have done it more. With pomp and circumstance, he should have made it a big deal. He said, quiet, and don't tell anybody. Saul comes back, and his uncle meets him. Where were you? And he gives a whole story, never letting on any of this. He kept it completely on the QT, okay? And that here, Saul expressed his modesty by not revealing Samuel's promise that he would be king, and thereby merited that Esther should descend from him. Okay, and now what the Gemara doesn't tell us is that Esther also had a situation where someone told her, don't tell anybody. Mordechai tells her, don't tell anybody your who you are, basically. But it's more than that. The Talmud tells us and other places is that Mordechai and Esther were married. Yes. You see that? She did such a good job. You don't even know about that.
Wasn't he your uncle? Right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's exactly why. They say, he said, like, they kept it on the QT. Oy. But the Talmud tells us, reading through the lines there, because it says, whatever it is, kasher avadati avadati, I'll be lost. I lost from my husband, Mordechai.
Oh.
Okay? So you see what a good job she kept. You're sitting here, I had to tell you that. It's so, like, hidden, okay? So now, let's look at this. Okay?
So he was her uncle, and they were married.
Correct. Okay, and then eventually she gets divorced from him because she becomes Ahasuerus' wife, and that's what's lost.
The fact that she was Jewish, she had to hide as well.
Right? Correct. All that. Okay, so now let's. I'm ready.
A lot of hiding going on.
So now, what the Talmud tells us is that Rachel had exhibited a certain, we call it, well, I'm going to say in Hebrew, tzniut. We're going to have to, I don't like the word modesty. or whatever. We have to because I guess the truth is it's lost in translation here. So we have to figure this out. But let's do this together. We have Rachel and her story with her sister and her future husband and her father. That begets us, whatever she did there, to have a child that is, an offspring of Saul, who clearly does what he does, and then an Esther that does. What's the common theme that the Gemara is telling us is running through these three people? So now, first, the easiest one is Saul and Samuel. Who is Saul protecting? Not a trick one, this is easy. Who's Saul protecting?
Samuel,
right? Why? Because Samuel is vulnerable. He has a vulnerability. If anybody found out that he did what he did without telling everybody, making it a big deal, he would have been flayed, okay? Fried and flayed and everything else. So Saul protects Samuel and his vulnerability. Now let's go back a step. And clearly Esther is protecting Mordechai. Not just herself, she's protecting. If anything, we all react like, what? He married her? He raised her? It's his niece? So it's like, okay, so clearly we don't react well. Her keeping that discreet is also protecting Mordechai's vulnerability. Let's go back to our first story. Who's Rachel protecting? So the first, everybody universally will say, Leah, right? No. The answer is no. Exactly. She's protecting Jacob. How so? Because the one thing, when you read the story, it's clear. Lavan is like this, like, you know, it's funny. Like, you know, people are strange. The guy can steal and cheat and everything else. But there's a certain rule that you got to keep. The older sister cannot be married after the younger. The younger sister can't be married before the older sister. That's just not acceptable. You can kill a guy.
For the rest of his life, he can screw over whoever he wants.
Right? So you see one thing.
Yeah.
This is something that is that's sacred, right?
Okay. Not negotiable.
So Jacob comes to town, and he proposes to the younger sister before the older sister. That's just not acceptable. Plus, also on top of it, he's showing up for the first time. He meets her, and he's proposing marriage. Like, what kind of guy is this, you know? That's just not how we do things in this town, you know? So for that to come out, because think about this. What could have done? Rachel could have gone the night before the marriage and said to father, we're on to you, Dad. You cannot blow this up. You cannot give my sister before me. You can't give Leah. Why? Because we already have it set up. You can't trick him. We know you're on to you. She could have gone right to him and cut it by the pass. So why didn't she? Why didn't she? Because it would make Jacob look like an idiot. So who is vulnerable? Jacob. So we start seeing a pattern. So what is this modesty that it's talking about? Sniut is something different than what we understand today. What sniut really is protecting someone else's vulnerability.
You kept using the word vulnerability.
Okay.
Which you hear? Works into modesty.
It does, right. So that's today, it's...
Well, that's how we got to modesty.
It's morphed into...
When you have no clothes on, you're vulnerable.
Right, exactly. And that's really the truth, is that's what it... If you think about it, going back to the beginning of time, when Adam and Eve are naked, they don't realize it until they eat from the tree that they're vulnerable. And then clothing becomes the thing that protects the vulnerability. But what really tzniut is, at its core, is protecting the vulnerable. Okay, now let's look at Deuteronomy 25, okay?
A new definition
of okay? Amalek. Who is Amalek? Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt, how undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary, and cut down all the stragglers in your rear. Who did they attack? Amalek.
The vulnerable.
The vulnerable. You hear? The vulnerable. The truth, the nature of this world, if you stop and think about it, our whole existence is we're all vulnerable. And when we care, we're even more vulnerable.
When we care, we're most vulnerable.
Mm. But to care is to be human and is to be the most exalted. To want to build, to want to grow, and to be optimistic is to be vulnerable. Amalek is the opposite. Evil is to destroy, to want to take things apart. You're building, I'm coming to destroy. That's Amalek. Amalek
using
is
using your vulnerability.
Yeah, well, they attack the vulnerability because their whole thing is to deconstruct, to be negative. That's Amalek. The Jewish people, God put us into this world to be his representatives, to make this world into something, to grow, to let it develop, to become something. The source of evil of Amalek is to do the counter. It's the counter force in creation. It comes from the beginning of time, before creation. There is this counterbalance to what we are, which is Amalek. It's evil. It's the power to want to destroy, to go after the vulnerable. So that's where they attack. So for us, when we look at, for example, this idea, the Gemara is saying, look who Esther is. She comes from a hidden place. She's everything is about, it's what goes on behind the closed doors. In all of our relationships, we're all vulnerable, and we have spouses, we have children, we have friends. The real relationships are always open and vulnerable. And our job to counter the Amalek is to protect the vulnerable, to be like Esther and Mordecai, to do things. It's not what you do out in the open. It's what you do behind in the quiet of your home, in your relationships, where there's no fanfare. But that's exactly where we kill Amalek. That's the joy of Adar. That's where true joy comes from. If we're able to work on the places of vulnerability and to be strengthened and protect like Esther did, and like Shaul and Rachel, and right? And in the sanctity of those quiet places, like where the Ketores is brought, like Mordechai does, what Mordechai represents, not what he does, but the idea of that it's in those places of vulnerability and our strengthening and being able to protect those things, that's really what brings salvation to the world. It brings salvation to ourselves, to our relationships, and to our families, and to our friends and everything else. Yeah? So that's Purim. That's like an idea of Purim. Because when we can connect to that and understand the power of that's such a special thing. To be in a place of vulnerability is a great thing. But to also be able to understand the sanctity of the vulnerability and to protect it and to be strengthened in that and to make walls around it, that's where the salvation comes from. Anochi Aster Aster. And then on top of that, what happens? See, that's the day is about publicizing the miracle. But what is it about? It's about giving to the poor. Those who are vulnerable, give to the poor. Strengthen your relationship with your friends. Give charity, give your gifts to your friends. And then come together. Because what happened is Esther said to, when she realized really what it's about, this is Haman, she said to Mordechai, go gather the Jewish people together. Gather and have them pray for me. Because I'm going to become, I understand this, it's the coming of becoming, but it's with the connection of the Jewish people as a whole. Because the Jewish people together as a whole, that's where the power comes from, right? And that's where we create a festive meal. A meal, it's like by the Karban Pesach, by definition, you had to eat in a very short period of time, which means you had to share with others. That's why they had like big groups of people coming together to celebrate. That's also, when it comes to festive meals, it's to be together with groups of people and to celebrate that idea of community, family, and then to expand it to community as well. Because as a Jewish people, it's the more that we're connected and we're unified, that's where our power comes from. But it starts in the quiet places, in the places of the vulnerability. So God willing, we should all be able to see that and then strengthen those places of our vulnerability. And that Hashem should give us the strength to make those strong, that we should be able to, the protections that we can create around it, and then grow and continue to grow. And in that way, the salvation will come. And that's a cause of great joy. It's not that, this is how it works. When does the salvation come? Is it because we're happy and therefore there's salvation, or is that there's salvation and therefore we're happy? And the answer is, it's because we're happy, that's when salvation comes. The opposite is that sadness brings destruction, and salvation is coming because we're happy. And happiness comes when we recognize the goodness that we have and that all the good that we can create for ourselves, we're happy. And then salvation comes. God willing, soon.
Amen.
Amen.
So connected to that idea of happiness,